Welcome to the All Souls Forum. Tonight we're going to hear from the town hall meeting on Medicare for All that was held just a couple of days ago with Dr. Weisbart, the Physicians for National Health Plan, and some other special guests. So we're going to get right to the program. And as always, the views expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and do not necessarily reflect the views of anyone else at KKFI.
As you may be aware, there are other countries in the world, and we have someone from another country. So I would like to introduce Louise Brooks. She is from Kansas City, and she's worked for many Fortune 500 companies, both here and in the United States. She moved to Sweden, which is a kingdom. I don't know if you know that. It's Kingdom of Sweden, actually. More than 20 years ago. She enjoys the benefits of universal health care there. Currently, she owns her own business. It has branches in Sweden and Kansas City. I don't think there's many businesses you're going to meet that have branches in Kansas City and Sweden. She is a member in the state legislature of her state in Sweden, and she's a member of the Social Democratic Party of Sweden, and that's the current ruling party federally in Sweden. So without further ado, we have Louise Brooks talk about her experiences with healthcare here and in Sweden.
I want to thank everybody. My name is Louise Brooks. I'm a U.S. citizen and I'm a registered voter in the state of Missouri and in Sweden. And I have to add one more thing to what he just said. I am a socialist here also. I'm a Bernie Sanders girl. I came back for 2016 to work his campaign. So I camped out in Kansas City to work for Bernie. So, and living in Sweden and coming back to the U.S., I had an interesting experience with healthcare to compare the two countries in healthcare. I broke my elbow last summer in two places. And you talk about something that's not very, that doesn't feel very good. It hurts when you move. So I go to a health facility here in Kansas City, and being over 65, I have the Medicare card. I think that's what it's called, the Medicare card. But when I get to the facility, I still have to pay $100 per visit. And so after about four visits, I called my doctor back in Sweden, and I told him that I was having this problem, and what happened was I kept going back. They put my arm in a cast, but I was allergic to the cast material. And so they took the cast off, and they put it in an ACE bandage and wrapped it up with gauze because it was injured around the elbow, so they wrapped it in gauze and they put it in an ACE bandage. And they sent me home without a coat on. And so I'm hurting and I'm in pain, and I called them, and they wanted my daughter to sign that she would be responsible for my health care bills. And I refused to put that burden on my daughter. So what I did was went back to Sweden, I went back to my second home, and called my doctor. I went in, had my surgery. It cost me only 200 kroner, which is about a little under $25 for the surgery. And that was all it cost me. And take in mind, we only pay $400 a year for medicine, hospitalization, lab work, and everything. Everybody only pays $400 a year. So you have good medical care. So I went to them and they fixed my arm, and I am just thankful that I have the opportunity that so many people don't have. So in Sweden, we believe that a healthy society is a prosperous society. And I just want you guys to think about what you are voting for and the kind of candidates you are voting for. and people, you know, that are going to vote and work for the people, that's the kind of candidate you want. And not just talkers, but also doers of the work. Okay, thank you.
Without further ado, it's an apple.
I tell people here and there that I am the only candidate for Congress anywhere in the country who's been inducted into the Kansas Music Hall of Fame. I also tell them it would be a much bigger honor if anyone had heard of the Kansas Music Hall of Fame, but you take what you can get. I will also tell you that thanks to my involvement with Bernie's campaign 2 years ago, and a lot of that had to do with Brent Welder helping me get involved. We worked very closely together 2 years ago, and I'm looking forward to working with Brent in Congress to get single-payer health care. I got elected to the Democratic National Committee 2 years ago, and I was deeply honored at the time. I've had time to think about it since. And I will tell you that it's every bit as bad as you think it is, but it's also largely irrelevant. If we want single-payer health care, if we want a guaranteed job for every worker in this country, and I'm quoting from the Democratic Party platform, a guaranteed job for everyone that pays enough to raise a family and live in dignity with a sense of purpose. What I realized is we've got to elect Democrats. Nina Turner said this at some training I was at back in April. Any old blue just won't do. I shared with Senator Turner at that point a plan for how to figure out which blues will do and which ones won't. It's called Our Promise to America. If you go to appleforthepeople.us, you'll find the full and exact text of Our Promise to America. You'll see that everything in quotation marks is, and it's extensive, most of the document is in quotation marks. Those are quotes from the Democratic Party platform. Among other things, it says, Democrats know that every child, no matter who they are, where they live, or how much their families earn, deserves access to a high-quality education from preschool through high school and beyond. Now, here's where it gets a bit tricky. I stuck to the Democratic Party platform. The Democratic Party platform does not call for Medicare for all. It calls for Medicare at 55. It calls for Medicaid expansion everywhere it's not been expanded, which includes Missouri, or as we pronounce it now, misery. And it includes a public option. The CHOICE Act has already been introduced. And as you know, H.R. 676, as Brent mentioned, has two-thirds of the Democrats on board. But what I tell people about this, when this issue comes up, most people don't know, and I've spoken to a lot of Democratic Party groups, and I tell them, did you know that the Democratic Party has a plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act? It's called Medicare for All. And if every Democrat in Congress was part of the Medicare for All caucus right now, we would be two senators, one if Pence would break the tie, maybe Trump could talk him into that, and we'd be about 20 representatives away from having Medicare for All. And if every Democrat in Congress would simply step up and do that, we could get it right now.
That's right.
But if we want it, we've got to replace those Democrats who won't vote for it with Democrats who will. We've got to know that any old blue just won't do it.
Thank you so much. It's so amazing to be here. And
You know, it's so amazing to have so many supporters in this room and people that, you know, understand how we're going to get these big ideas accomplished like Medicare for All, and that it has to happen at the grassroots level. And so many people in this room have been knocking doors for our campaign, making calls, writing postcards. And, you know, because here's the thing. When you go out and talk to people and you ask them, is healthcare a human right? Should every single woman, man, and child in America be able to go to the doctor if they get hurt or injured or diseased? People say yes. People say yes. Democratic politicians even say yes a lot of times. They say yes, it's a human right. But the thing is that if that's the case, then we need to start treating a human right like a real human right. And right now, even with the ACA, which made a lot of good progress, there's still 10% of the people in this country who are without health insurance. And you know, I'm the father of a 5-year-old daughter, a 2-year-old daughter, and what I say to the people who say, you know, it's not a human right, that we shouldn't have single-payer healthcare for every single woman, man, and child in this country, is I say, bring me that little girl that you think doesn't deserve to be able to go to the doctor if she is injured or diseased or sick. Bring her to me. Bring her to me and explain to her in front of me and look her in the eyes and explain to her exactly why she does not deserve to have adequate health treatment with the disease that she's struggling with. Bring me the working mother that's working 3 jobs but can't get health insurance and can't have benefits, and explain to her right in front of me why she, working as hard as she is, trying to take care of her family, trying to take care of her children, does not deserve simple, basic, quality health care. And at the end of the day, nobody feels that way. Nobody feels like these people do not deserve to have this basic human right. And when I started this campaign, it was actually over a year ago now. I think it was a year ago this week. I don't think any candidate in the history of my district had ever run on a platform of single-payer healthcare on Medicare for All. And the people who were telling me most not to do it were the DC establishment folks, the DC consultants. People told me, no way, don't do it. It's not popular. They're going to attack you for it. But I did it anyway. I started running on it. I started running on it a year ago. I did something else that all the DC establishment folks said not to do, and I put my entire progressive platform on our website at BrentWelder.com. And what I have found is that these working people, middle class people, poor people across our district, across Kansas, their face lights up and they get so much hope when you start talking to them about these ideas that they have never heard a candidate in my district talk about before. And they want to get involved for the first time ever. They want to start voting for the first time ever, or for the first time in a long time. And this is exactly how we are going to create and continue to build the movement to achieve Medicare for All. And you know what? Since then, 2/3 of the Democrats in the House of Representatives have co-sponsored Medicare for All legislation. And you know, I'm the only Democrat in this race that's really pushing hard for Medicare for All. I'm the one that's going to co-sponsor it and join the Medicare for All caucus. Because together we are going to achieve this amazing change and get this extremely important healthcare policy accomplished once we get there. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
We would like to introduce Dr. Wiesbart. He's a family physician in St. Louis, Missouri, or Missouri, as he emphasized I should call it, Missouri. He is the chair of the Missouri chapter of Physicians for a National Health Plan. He's been advocating for single-payer healthcare for years. He's made many media appearances and debates on single-payer, sometimes with very conservative people. It's very interesting. You'll look him up on YouTube. And he's done this throughout the Midwest. He's a great speaker, and we're excited to have him here in Kansas City for the second year in a row. And he wanted us to all be reminded that this is the 53rd anniversary of Medicare. And 53 years ago, 53 years ago, Congress passed and President Lyndon Johnson signed a law guaranteeing medical care for all, and over 65 though. And we should all know that the major problem with that is it didn't include us under 65. So we now have a chance to correct that, and Dr. Wiesbart is going to explain to us exactly how the Physicians for National Health Plan has a model and how it will work. So without further ado, Dr. Wiesbart.
So clearly I need to move to Kansas City. This is an amazing city. Thank you for being here. Thanks for having me. Thanks to Melody and Jane for all the work that you've done putting this together again. So how cool is this? This is really exciting to get the chance to talk to you guys. So I have a feeling I may be among the most conservative person, one of the more conservative people in this room. Raise your hand if you're a capitalist like me. Yeah, no, don't do that. You'll get stoned out of the room. But that's the point, isn't it? The point is that you can come at these issues from a variety of points of view and come to the same answer. And what I want to do tonight, if I could, is to kind of little walk you through a bit of how I got to this point of view that Medicare for All makes the most sense. I'm going to sort of help you understand how I got to that point of view, and then we'll explain a bit about how it would actually work. But we'll spend most of the time talking about the business side of this. Those of you who had a chance to pay attention to the news even today and a little bit yesterday, there's a new data point about the economics of Medicare for All that I'd like to discuss with you. So we'll go through that, and I believe we'll be ending that part of the discussion with a pretty upbeat message about the traction that we've been getting, the landscape shift that's happened in our country over the last just 5 years, the last 2 or 3 years particularly. So we'll kind of go with that. And along the way, you'll get a chance to meet my family. So full HIPAA disclosure, I have my mother-in-law and my wife's permission to tell you their medical stories. So if there's a HIPAA cop out there, you know, we got it covered, man. So anyway, I'm a physician. Hopefully you can see the slides. Can you see that? Wait a minute. I'm a physician that serves my mind a core of who I am, but I've got involved in the business community and then more recently in political advocacy. As a physician, I practiced for 20 years family medicine in Chicago, delivering babies and taking care of old folks and everything in between. When I moved to St. Louis, I started volunteering at essentially a free clinic, which I still do at least once a week, and a variety of other charities or care for the uninsured, basically. I moved to St. Louis to work at Express Scripts, where I was the chief medical officer. That's a pharmacy benefit company. And I bring that up to say that it taught me the importance of having a business case for the changes that you want to make. It's one thing to have a great idea, but in order to really make them gain traction, they have to be a good idea. They also have to make sense for the economics of the country, and they have to make sense for the finances of most individual Americans. And I'm persuaded that we have that in this proposal to you. And I want to arm you with the information around that so that when you're talking with folks who aren't quite as far along as you are on this curve, you have things you can tell them. You know, you have information. So that's sort of, I got that idea basically from my life there. And then I retired from that in 2010 and put together the Missouri chapter of this group called Physicians for a National Health Program. We're a nonprofit, a 501c3, so we do not endorse candidates, even those that we like a lot. We don't endorse candidates or political parties. We just speak about policy, and so that's what we're here to do. We're all volunteers, or almost all volunteers. I'm certainly a volunteer, and we're just here because we think it's incredibly important. So I'm glad that you're here to listen to us. And in Missouri, we also advocate for Medicaid expansion. So that's me in a nutshell. I started here, basically. This is the place where my first clinic, where I spent most of my time at, was in Chicago. And it was part of why I went to medical school. It's what's called a staff model health maintenance organization. It was almost entirely capitated, prepaid, and I'll explain what that means to you. And that was most of my practice, and I thought it was a great idea. I thought that was a good way to change healthcare. The way that works is, well, we had 150,000 people that were this way. So employers and patients paid an insurance company, right? Your premiums or what? And then the insurance company paid us, the physicians, the medical group, a certain amount every month to do all of your health care, to take care of you when you were in the hospital, to pay your hospital bill, to pay for your CAT scan. We paid for everything out of the monthly fee that we got. And I actually thought at the time that was great, and that was brilliant, because that then meant that it was our goal to make you healthy, right? If I could do something that would make you healthier, I was living on a budget, but if I could make you healthier, then that would mean I would come out ahead financially. And I thought that was a good thing to do to the medical system. Make doctors have skin in the game for making you healthier. What a great idea. So we did that. And we actually were one of the best in the country at this. And we did it by doing all the kinds of things you would want a healthcare system to do. We did it by colon cancer screenings and huge vaccination campaigns and all the stuff that you want a good healthcare system to do. We did that. We did it in spades, and we wanted that. It was great. We were very proud of how good the care was we delivered to our patients. And then this one guy came in. So we had about 10 offices around Chicago, and we set them each up on their own, basically. And one of them was the jewel of the system. It had about 4,000 patients. It had, I think, two internists, and they had the best of the scores on all this stuff. They were the most profitable of the offices. They were doing great. Patients loved them. They were doing great. And then they got this one patient. He drove a truck for environmental services, trash collection, basically. And he was in an accident and got a crush injury. And that revealed the fact that he actually had hemophilia. So you probably know hemophilia is a bleeding disorder. It means you can't clot. I don't want to make this too graphic for you, but it used to be almost a death sentence if you had a bad case of it. You did, but we can treat this now. Hemophilia is incredibly treatable. What we do is we infuse you by IV the factor that you can't produce genetically, and then you can make clots. Hooray! So people with hemophilia today often live completely normal lives. The problem was this guy needed an awful lot of that thing, that factor, and it was costing our medical group $1 million a year to treat him. $1 million a year to treat him. And so we quickly figured out that all of those vaccinations that we gave, all of those colon cancer screenings that we did that were the right thing to do, didn't matter, because this one patient who was so sick turned the office from being a profitable office into being almost had to go out of business. So that doesn't make any sense. Why would you want to do that? Why would you want to set? So we were, the business imperative for us was actually for us to make him not want to come see us. It was to make him unhappy with us, to stand in his way, say, oh, let me put you on hold, to not be receptive, to make him unhappy and let him leave our practice. Well, that's not right. That's not the way you want to set up a healthcare system, but that's not just what was happening to us. That's what insurance does too. That's how insurance works. Insurance is basically punished today. The more they have sick people, the less profitable they are. So they don't want sick people. Isn't that crazy? Our healthcare system shuns the sick. And the point, of course, is that it's today's system. It's the wrong system. So what's the right system? Well, you've heard it a few times. It's Medicare for All, I think. Well, that says Medicare for All. What's so special about Medicare? Why Medicare, aside from today being its birthday? What's so special about Medicare? There's a number of things, but probably the most important thing is how incredibly simple it is. How incredibly simple it is. So here's the first Medicare member. It was Harry Truman. The bill was enacted in 1965, July 30th, 1965. And if you can see there, he became active July 1st, 1966, less than a year. In other words, it took less than a year for Medicare to go from not existing to enrolling 15 or so million Americans. 0 to 100. It's from not existing to full coverage for 15 million people in less than a year. The only way you can do that is if it's incredibly simple. And Medicare, that's the key message. Medicare is an incredibly simple system. And nobody can describe today's healthcare system here as simple. But there are three important things about it that I don't think are very widely recognized. So the first is that it puts you, us, individuals, in control of our healthcare in a way that we don't have today. It eliminates an awful lot of the waste that's strangling our country. And lastly, it actually extends lives. So let me, if I could, unpack this a little bit. And to unpack it, I need to introduce you to my mother-in-law. I promised you. And there she is. Isn't she pretty? Say yes.
Yes!
So I think she is. So my mother-in-law, so I'm one of these people that doesn't understand mother-in-law jokes. If you tell me a mother-in-law joke, I like don't get it. It's not funny to me. Because I really adore my mother-in-law. I'm just really lucky that way. And it's a good thing, because a time machine, she looks like my wife in the future. So, it's a good thing I like her, and I really do. And as I said, I have her permission to tell you this story, and it involves her. So Ma is 89 now, and she lives near Daytona Beach in Florida. And she has a rare genetic condition in her heart, Holcomb, for the doctors, or she has Holcomb. And it's one of these rare genetic things that doesn't actually, despite being genetic, it doesn't actually manifest itself until you're in your 70s, maybe around there someplace. And that's what happened to her. In her mid-70s, she started having these symptoms of a really bad heart problem, and it's fatal eventually. So it turns out that it's so rare that there's only actually three places in the country that focus on treating it. And one of those three places is in St. Louis. None of them are in Florida. So my mother-in-law, we were able to fly her from Florida to St. Louis, have her in the hospital for several days. She got literally world-class treatment and went home after recovery and all that, and did great. This was 6.5 years ago now. She has since had two partial knee replacements. She's doing great. She would not have lived through surgery. So Ma's doing great. Why am I telling you about this? Because my mother-in-law has Medicare, and she has a supplement. And with Medicare, she can go anywhere she wants to. So she wanted to come here, she didn't have to ask for permission. And with the supplement, she didn't have any copays or deductibles or anything. She was able to just come here and get the care. Now my wife, Cindy, may have this problem. She has some suggestive symptoms. So she doesn't have it on the test as yet, but she may have it. But let's say she did, and let's say Cindy had to go to Pittsburgh, not St. Louis. Well, Pittsburgh wouldn't be in my network, right? I pay $2,000 a month, if I do, for premium for my wife and myself to have insurance. And that comes with a $6,000 individual, $12,000 family deductible. So if Cindy needed, I'm not making that up. So if Cindy needed, actually it changed a month ago, because Cindy now has Medicare, but that's another story. Woo! Keys to the kingdom. So if Cindy needed to go, back when this was true, if she needed to go to Pittsburgh, my insurance that I would have been paying at least $24,000 a year for wouldn't have paid a penny. And I'm guessing that my mother-in-law's health care in St. Louis was around $100,000, I'm gonna guess. So not very many, most Americans can't come up with $1,000 for an unexpected medical problem. Nobody can come up with $100,000 for an unexpected, so they die, is what they do. So my mother-in-law was able to come to St. Louis and get wonderful care, and I don't have that kind of insurance, and very few of you have that kind of insurance. So if you think about messing with Medicare, you have to deal with this. And trust me, you don't want to deal with that. Not that I've ever done anything to trigger that face, but you don't want to deal with that. So I said she can go anywhere. Is that really true? But well, we all know there are doctors who won't take Medicare today. So how good is this? Well, there's almost 700,000 physicians in practice in the United States today. And of those 700,000, almost 10,000 will not accept Medicare. So you'll hear this, right? You'll hear, Medicare for all, are you crazy? There's doctors who won't even take Medicare. Well, and that's true. There are doctors who won't. There are thousands of doctors who won't. But there are literally hundreds of thousands who do. So the arithmetic's pretty simple. More than 98% do take Medicare today. In other words, if you have Medicare, unlike if you have Cigna, as I do, if you have Medicare, you can go to virtually any doctor and virtually any hospital in the United States. You get to make your decisions, and we all should have that. So that's the first thing. Medicare puts you in control. The second thing is it means we stop wasting our money. I don't like wasting money. So let me show you this. Here's the overhead of the insurance company. So any of my slides that have numbers, as this one does, there's a reference at the bottom, which is too small for you to read, but it's there so that if you doubt my data, I can tell you exactly, I can go here right now and tell you exactly where each data point comes from. So we have that here so you can see it. Don't worry about reading it up. If you need to know, let me know and I'll tell you. So this is SEC filings for the larger insurance companies, and what do you think their overhead is? Well, it's not quite that bad. The SEC filings say their overhead is between 15 and 20% of the large insurance companies. So what's the overhead for Medicare? Part A and B, traditional Medicare, not the Advantage plans, not the pharmacy benefit, just Part A and B. What's the overhead for traditional Medicare?
You don't get it.
5%. Anybody else? 2%. Oh, we have a winner. Yeah, it's 2.2. And that's not magic, right? That's not magic. That's because over here, you got to pay for television ads. You got to pay for literally multi-million dollar salaries. And over here, you know, you don't get those kinds of things at all, ever. And it turns out this involves an awful lot of people. If you look at just hospitals, and just look at billing and accounts receivable in hospitals, we actually have 900,000 hospital beds in the United States. And we have 900,000 people working in hospitals in billings and accounts receivable. In other words, the average hospital in the United States, some more, some less, but the average hospital in the United States could put somebody from billing at the foot of every bed. Seriously, they can't do that with nurses, physical therapists, physicians, anything else but the billing department. And that's an awful lot of people. We're going to talk about the impact on jobs in a few minutes. But that's an awful lot of people just to deal with billing. That's more people than the entire world employee count for Ford, General Motors, and Toyota. If you combine every employee in the world for Ford, General Motors, and Toyota, you come up with about 770,000 people. We have more people in just the billing and insurance-related side in hospitals than Ford, General Motors, and Toyota combined in the world. And that's a lot of people. So the last of these three things I would say about Medicare is that it makes us healthier. And this is my wonkiest chart. I promise you it's my wonkiest chart. But bear with me, it's wonky, but it's incredibly important. Otherwise, I wouldn't show this to you, but it's incredibly important. So bear with me, it's worth kind of really focusing on this. So you knew before I started speaking that American life expectancies are 2 or 3 years shorter than life expectancies in many other modern nations. You knew that before I came in, and that's true despite our spending roughly double what any other country spends. You knew that, so there's that. Well, what you may not have looked at is, well, let me show you. So here's our mortality rate, really. I think of it as life expectancy, but it's mortality rate. Compared to 17 other peer nations, Australia, Italy, France, Germany, Sweden, Norway, Sweden, is on the list, wherever Louise went to. So here's our life expectancy or mortality rate compared to all those other countries. And you know, as I already told you, and you knew before you came in, you know we're going to be at the bottom of this chart, number 17, more or less. You knew that. That's where we'll be. But this chart is by age. Now that's the different piece about this. So here's a 3-year-old American's life expectancy or mortality rate compared to 3-year-olds elsewhere in the modern world. Here's me. There's a 64-year-old American's life expectancy compared to 64-year-olds in Italy, Germany, and France. And then there's my mother-in-law, 89. 89-year-olds compared to 89-year-olds elsewhere in the modern world. So the first part of this chart you kind of knew, right? There we are, happily cruising at the bottom, spot number 17 for the most part. You knew that. What you didn't know is this. I could go home. To me, that's the most compelling. Yeah, right answer. We have a literal jaw drop. So, right answer. Once we turn 65, this amazing thing happens. Country by country, year by year, we become the healthiest in the world. The healthiest in the world. Our mortality rate becomes the best in the world. And I submit to you, the only way you can do that is if you have many of the world's best doctors and hospitals and nurses and all that stuff, and the world's best finance system. We have a solution to how to deliver healthcare in the United States. We have a spectacular solution for that. That's why you see all these, you know, rich Saudi sheiks or whomever come here, because if you can get in, our healthcare system is arguably the best in the world. The problem is we just don't let everybody in. So we should be hugely proud of this and realize that what we have to fix is very specific. We should fix other things too, but that's a pretty important thing to understand. So what is Medicare for All? It turns out it's actually a really simple concept, but let me unpack it for you so you really understand what it is. Because you know, I just think it's good to really understand. So here's all of us, right? And then here's all the stuff we want. We want doctors and pharmacists and nurses and all that stuff. And in between us, of course, is the money, right? And the money today is managed by payers. So we pay our taxes to the United States government, that they pay for healthcare for the post office, and the military, and they pay Medicare, they pay half or so of Medicaid. So we pay them, and then they pay for all that stuff. They're a payer. So is the state of Missouri. They pay for the healthcare for state employees, and half of Medicaid. So are cities, so are schools, so are all the businesses, and so are all these insurance companies. These are all what's called payers. So we have what's called a multi-payer system. It's incredibly complicated, and we could replace this incredibly complicated mess with a very simple solution. Get it? Now you know what single payer means. It means a single payer. Or I think the most prudent way to set that up is to build on our success, Medicare, just improve Medicare. So you'll hear us say improve Medicare for all. Medicare is far from perfect. There are two main things that need to be improved in Medicare. When you hear people say improve Medicare for all, what does that mean? Two main things, other stuff too, but two main things. First, we need to improve get rid of the financial barriers. So most seniors who just have seniors who have traditional Medicare have to deal with what's called an 80-20 rule. They have to pay 20% of a hospital expense with no limit on that. They have co-pays and deductibles. So there are financial barriers in traditional Medicare, and that's why most seniors who can afford to do as my mother-in-law did and buy a supplement, which does just that. It supplements Medicare, and it gets rid of the huge deductibles and the 80-20 rule and all that stuff. It supplements Medicare. It doesn't change Medicare, it just supplements it. So Medicare Advantage is completely different from that. This, we're talking about Medicare. Medicare Advantage is essentially the government buying you Humana insurance. It's not Medicare. So you have to go back to dealing with networks and directories. With Medicare, you don't have to deal with any of that stuff. So that's the first thing, is get rid of the financial barriers. The second thing is to expand the benefits. Because Medicare doesn't cover some things that most of us think Medicare should cover. It doesn't cover dentistry, it doesn't cover hearing aids, eyeglasses. There's a list of things that Medicare should cover. But of course, if you're gonna have to cover more things, who would pay for that? Would Americans wanna pay for that? Yes, they would, actually. If you ask them specifically, would you be willing to have a payroll tax increase so that people on Medicare have long-term care coverage or any of these hearing aids, dental care, glasses? Most Americans, 3 out of 4 Americans generally, would say, you know, yeah, I want Granny to have eyeglasses if she can't read or can't see to drive. Most Americans are okay with that. We don't like the idea of a tax increase because that's sort of amorphous. But if you say, would you be willing to have a change in your taxes so that you can have glasses to seniors, 3 out of 4 Americans say, yeah, that's good, sign me up. But you didn't quite realize how strong the country is about this. So that's what we mean by improve Medicare. And then expand it means give it to everybody. Give it to everybody. Give it to Congress. Give it to the president. Give it to school teachers. Give it to kids. If you gave it to kids, for example, then we wouldn't have to have these fights over should we renew CHIP. We wouldn't have to have that fight. If we gave it to people regardless of income, you wouldn't have one state saying, well, I expanded Medicaid. Well, I didn't expand Medicaid. There wouldn't be a need for Medicaid because everybody would have this improved Medicare, right? You wouldn't have Medicaid. You wouldn't have CHIP. You wouldn't have any of that stuff because why would you? Everybody would have Medicare. Get it? So the first thing is to include everybody in it. That's the only way to go from those big, scary red bars of 15, 20%, not 30% overhead that I showed you, that chart with those almost frightening big red bars of overhead. That's the only way to go from those big red bars of waste down to the little 2% overhead that Medicare has. So it eliminates wasteful overhead. It also makes it sustainable and stable. If everyone is in this, a legislator who tried to hurt it would be hurting the healthcare for their own family. It makes it much more sustainable. And then lastly, it deals with the problem that my medical group had with that one patient with hemophilia. When you have 4,000 people, one really sick person is an unpredictable. If you're an employer and you have 200 employees and one of those employees got hemophilia, you might find that your premium next year is so high that you can't stay in business and provide a health insurance benefit. When you break it down to 200 people here or 5,000 people there, it's not a stable thing. So the most stable thing, of course, is for everyone to be in this. And if you did that, then of course there would be no market for an advantage program, because we'd all have that advantage. So enough of this. The most important question, I think, for most people, especially today, really, is can we afford it? So there are 25, and now 26, as of today, studies that have looked at this. And despite the news, actually 26 studies, independent studies over a long period of time, that have looked at the economics of Medicare for All, and every one, even the new one, I'll explain to you in a moment, every one of these 26 studies had said, of course we can afford it. Every other country figured out how they can afford it. Of course we can. Some said we would break even, some said a big savings, but none of these 26 say we can't afford it. There are two other studies that say we can't afford it, and you need to understand them because you need to be able to look for these flaws. So I'm going to walk you through at a very high level just one. And here's the new one. This is the one that was in the news, saying in the news today. Did you see this thing in the news today?
Yeah.
This thing that the Koch brothers sponsored? And the news was that Medicare for All will raise your taxes. Yeah, of course it would. We'll walk through the detail of that in a moment. But if you read the study, and I actually did, it's public domain, you can download the study, open it up, it's about 20 pages, I think, and you can look at it, and it says the most remarkable thing. It says, despite the scary headlines, it literally says in the numbers that a Medicare for All program over a 10-year period of full implementation using the Sanders model, that a Medicare, and this is using the most conservative assumptions you can use. This is the Koch brothers coming up with what they think is the most, and you know, right or wrong, you gotta agree that they're coming from a really conservative point of view. And their conclusion was that this program would be $2 trillion cheaper today. So here's the trajectory that we're on today, according to all projections, pretty much. And there we are, you know, going up to a pretty big number, trillions of dollars. And according to this study, just using the numbers out of this study, there's the national spend under Medicare for All. So their study says that there would be a $2 trillion savings to the country for doing this. And I happen to have spoken today with one of the most prominent economists on this, Gerald Friedman. About this, and his estimate, sort of, you know, done quickly today, is that no, it's not $2 trillion cheaper, it's more like $12 trillion cheaper. Now, that's a preliminary thing that he just did today. I do have his permission to tell you that, but in writing. But the point is, even in a worst case scenario, it's cheaper to go down this road. So this particular economist, who's the head of economics at the University of Massachusetts, so in the study I'm about to show you, he's going to be here in Kansas City on Tuesday, December 4th. So hopefully when you came in, you gave your contact information to the folks here, but for sure before you leave, make sure that we all have your contact information so that we can tell you exactly where he's going to be in town when he's on the city tour. But Tuesday, December 4th, 6 o'clock, mark your calendar. So he'll be here. Here's one study that he did that I wanted to quote to you. I'm not going to walk you through 26 studies. I'm going to walk you through just this one. And he said, of course there would be new costs, but there would be new savings. And the new savings would be bigger than the new costs. So, okay, let's look at this. What are the new costs? He says, one is that you'd have to pay more for Medicaid patients, right? So in Missouri, if I see you and you have Medicaid, the state will pay me about $30 for that visit. If I see you and you have Medicare, I'll get about $100 for that visit. And if I see you and you have Blue Cross, I'm going to get about $130 for that visit. Which means I have to figure out what you're worth to me before I let you into my practice. And that makes me sick. I don't want to do that. It means I got to see you as often as I can convince you to come in, and you know I can't afford to see you hardly at all. And that's why Medicaid patients in states like Missouri have such a hard time getting a doctor to see them, because we're working retail, right? And we have to pay attention to that. We hire staff to pay attention to that. So Friedman's analysis says, well, We're not going to do that. We're going to pay doctors the same for every patient so that you no longer have that differential to think about. And there's an expense to that. So if we did that around the country, in his estimate, $74 billion more for doing that. Big money, but there's an amount. We also have to pay something for people who don't have insurance today, an even bigger amount. We want them to start getting health care, as you heard earlier. And then lastly, everybody would start doing things, right? They go to the dentist, they go do stuff. Stuff that we want people to be able to do. So I told you there were two studies that came to a different conclusion. One stopped here, literally stopped there, and said, well, there's new costs. We can't do something that has new costs, crazy. Well, you know, we can disagree about politics, philosophy, strategy, tactics, all of that stuff, but we can't just look at new costs and pretend that there's no new savings. So if you're looking at a study, and this is really important because, you know, the study that came out today is kind of monkey, as I already explained to you, I think. It doesn't even say what it says it said. But there's going to be another study that's going to come out in 2020, I promise you, during the build-up to the general election. And it's going to also say we can't afford to, and you need to know what to look for in that study. And one thing to look for is, well, what did they say for savings? And I'm telling you, one of the studies last year said there were no savings at all, zero. That's crazy. So what are the savings that they ignored? Well, one thing is, of course, the government would be running one program, not dozens of programs, so that's cheaper to do. It's a bigger program, so it's not a lot cheaper, but it's one. Second, health insurance administration would be a huge savings because we wouldn't need most of that activity. And again, we'll get to jobs in a moment. There would be a huge savings to doctors and hospitals. The average physician has about $85,000 in office staff who do nothing but manage the insurance companies. $85,000, that means you can actually pay me that much less and I would be whole. I'm not recommending you do that. But the point is that you can recoup those savings. The average physician has $85,000 in staff who manage it. So there would be a savings here. And lastly, for crying out loud, you have to let this system negotiate the prices of drugs and devices. It's happening. So that's surprise. That's the easiest thing to look for in a study. And surprisingly, in that second study that I was mentioning, or two, that's one of the most glaring flaws in it, was that they accounted for no savings. We can argue about how much, but they said no savings from negotiating the prices of drugs and devices. So, you know, when the next study comes out, look to see what they said for savings, and then unpack it a little bit further and see, well, how much did they save for drugs? And remember, Jerry Friedman said $178 billion. So look at that. But those of you who are savvy and thinking about this have noticed that there's a disconnect between the right hand and the left hand here, right? I talked about all these new costs that are real, and I talked about these new savings, but giving me $85,000 less of office staff doesn't actually fund the new program. So how do you get from here to here? And it's that thing that the newspaper today was so surprised by. It's called taxes. It's called taxes. Now, the bills, the one in the House and in the Senate, are remarkably skinny about how exactly you would set up the tax structure. And that's not by ignorance or accident. That's because there are maybe 15 or 20 reasonable ways to change the tax structure. There are many reasonable ways to do that. So you could make the progressive income tax more progressive, right? You could do that. You could take the progressive income tax and just sort of raise it so that everybody goes up a fixed amount. You could do it on employer taxes. You could do it on sales taxes. You could do it on unearned income. You could do it on any of a variety of things. And chances are in the United States, what we would do is we would eventually settle on a blend of this. We would do a bunch of things. So there are many good tax solutions. There simply has to be, if this makes sense, right? Of course there would be. And at the end of the day, most economists would say that 95% of Americans would spend less, right? Yes, the tax increase would be real, but it would be smaller than getting rid of premiums and co-pays and deductibles. And you would suddenly have dental insurance and eyeglass insurance and hearing aid insurance and all of these other things. So yes, your taxes, our taxes, would go up in some way, but the savings from getting rid of premiums and deductibles and all this other stuff is bigger for 95% of Americans. In general, if you make more than about $400,000 a year, you'd probably, depending on the tax solution, you'd probably pay a little bit more than you would save. So raise your hand if you're making more than $400,000. So the point is, we can afford to do this, and there's a lot of good strategies to get there. But of course, the question is, well, what does this mean for jobs? Because I'll bet you were also scratching your head when I started to say that all these folks doing healthcare administration, well, what happens to those jobs, their jobs? And so let's look at this, and it's a big number, and unemployment is a big deal. If you lose your job, it doesn't just affect you, it affects your family, it means you buy less, so it affects your community. It's a big deal. So I don't want to make light of this, but I want to first put a size on it, so you see how many jobs is the worst case probably. Then I want to talk about a few very real mitigation strategies. And then lastly, and I think more importantly, I want to put it in a context for you. So first, how big is this? Well, it's big. It's a big number, so get ready for this number. There are roughly 400,000 people today working within the insurance industry. Many of my friends do that today. And those jobs in the insurance industry would pretty much go away under the model that we're proposing. There are other models that actually don't eliminate the insurance industry. They're more expensive, and I don't think that's the thing to aim for. But under this model, 400,000 people working in the insurance industry would be displaced. And it gets worse. There are roughly 2.6 million people working in hospitals and physician offices managing insurance functions beyond the ones I mentioned. And roughly half of those would be displaced. So we're talking about, worst case scenario, about 1.7 million jobs. And I don't know about you, but that gives me pause. That gives me palpitations. That's a big number. So there's some things to think about. The first thing to think about is some of these jobs are terrific jobs, but most of these jobs are data entry, call center jobs that people aren't actually that satisfied with. And as a consequence, most of the jobs we're talking about have a 25% annual turnover. Most of these jobs have a 25% annual turnover. So no matter what you do today, 2 years from now, more than half of these folks are not going to be in those jobs already. So let's stay with the 1.7 million number. This could be worst case about this, but understand that really half of those, I think you have to think remember this context. So what do you do about these folks? Well, both bills, the one in the House and the Senate, have given this quite a bit of thought. And the first thing, and both the most important and least important, is that both bills talk about income guarantee. So roughly 100, if your job is displaced in the first few years of the bill being passed, up to $100,000 of income is guaranteed to you for 2 to 5 years, depending on the bill. So guaranteed income if your job is displaced for 2 to 5 years, and then unemployment and job retraining and all that other stuff. So that's important. It's a safety net. It's also the least important part of the solution because nobody wants income guarantee, I don't think. People want meaningful jobs. They want to do work that adds meaning and value. So income guarantee, that's fine. You know, we need that there, but really it's more what do we do in terms of giving people meaningful work? Well, there's a lot of thought about that too. The first is there's a lot of clinical things that we need done that there's no business case for today. So one example is seniors who are shut into their home and don't have friends and are very socially isolated. They wind up getting hospitalized frequently. And it turns out if you send not a nurse, not a physician, if you send anyone with minimal training to their house every couple weeks just to say, hey, how you doing? And check in, just a social visit almost. Hey, I noticed the digits are piling up. That's not like you. What's wrong? If you send somebody in, that reduces hospitalizations. And so suddenly you have a business case for not nurses and doctors, they have too, but for really lots of people to be doing things in healthcare that pays for itself. Doulas, I mean, there's all kinds of jobs that don't require 10 years of training that would, for which there would now be a business case. So expanded clinical workforce, and then expanded non-clinical workforce. You know, U.S. businesses that today describe healthcare as a lead weight around their ankle that makes them lose when they try to compete globally and keep wages flat. You know, suddenly businesses could start to grow more fruitfully in the United States. Businesses from outside the country that want to relocate here, it can't. There's a factory in Canada run by a member of the Canadian Conservative Party who wants to relocate to the United States, right? He gets his raw materials here, ships them up to Canada, and he works on them there, and then he ships his finished product back down to the United States, where most of his customers are. He would rather get rid of that shipping and relocate here and employ American citizens. He'd rather do that. He can't, because the arithmetic works out, our healthcare is so much more expensive, that would add $1 million to his bottom line unfavorably, and he just can't do that. So the point is, American businesses would grow, very stimulative to the economy, and other countries would be more comfortable employing folks. And then lastly, of course, to repeat this, there'd be an income tax. So that's the mitigation strategy, but I think even more important than that is the context. So we said 1.7 million people, that's a lot of people. A single hit of 1.7 million people. So how many people lose jobs today? There's data. If you go back 20 years or so, for the last 18 years, I guess this is, roughly 20 to 30 million Americans every year quit their job today. Every year, 20 or 30 million Americans quit their job today. And another 20 million or so are fired every year. And then another 5 million or so for other reasons change jobs. So in other words, today, and for the last two decades, and probably for the foreseeable future, something on the order of 60 million Americans change jobs every year now. Ongoing, sea of this. And we're talking about 1.7 million people as a single time hit, and probably much less than that, and with mitigation strategies. So I'm gonna skip, you wanna hear about Canada? Yeah, I'll tell you about Canada. So the system that we're describing is similar to what they do in Canada. And people often say, well, Canada, that's so different. It's further north. You can't compare. Isn't that a suburb of Chicago? You can't compare. So it turns out you can compare the United States with Canada. Because if you go back to 1971, our healthcare systems were performing almost the same. In 1971, our healthcare costs as a percentage of our GDP were almost identical to those in Canada, and our life expectancies were just a few months apart. And then in 1973, President Nixon signed into law the HMO Act, creating managed care to reduce the cost of healthcare. And in 1971, Canada fully implemented their Medicare program around all the provinces. They call it Medicare. So how did this look? Well, it turns out here's our healthcare costs were rising mercilessly over the last 20 years. There's the HMO Act making no impact on our healthcare costs as a percentage of GDP. You knew that. Here's Canada's data. Ever seen that before? We did last year if you were here. But Canada was the same, and then they put in this new policy, and suddenly we were the same, then we were different. What about the waiting list? People complain about the waiting list in Canada, right? And Canadians complain about the waiting list in Canada. If you ask them, they have this concern too. So what do they look like? So in Canada, a knee replacement, if you ask most Americans, we would say you probably have to wait like 6 years for things in Canada. And there are anecdotes, right? But actually the data says knee replacements less than 4 months, hip replacements about 3 months, cataract surgery, prostate, and angioplasty bypass less than a week for non-emergent stuff. So that's the numbers. In the United States, what do those numbers look like? Well, nobody knows. Because the waiting list for somebody with Blue Cross is different from the waiting list for somebody for Cigna. It's different from the time you have to wait if you have Medicaid. And if you don't have insurance, you're not even on the list. There's no comparable data for the United States. If you sum it all up, in Canada, 80% of Canadians wait less than 4 months. There's the number to remember. 80% of Canadians wait less than 4 months for elective surgery. In the United States, of course, nobody knows. And then life expectancy, here they were, this is 1979, I don't have all the comparable data. Life expectancy, Canadians were living about a year longer than we were 6 years into this, and now they live almost 3 years. Now they do live 3 years longer than we do. So in other words, live longer, spend a lot less.
Thank you for tuning in to this edition of All Souls Forum. Stay tuned for American Roots right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.